Welcome back to the LAN Podcast. Hope you guys had a great weekend. This week we have part two with Nicholas and Kent from Hoxie Native Seed. And this part of the conversation is diving more into the movement of native plants and improving our habitat for all species, and obviously whitetail there too. And part of this conversation is about their whitetail habitat blend, which is really interesting because there is so many different native species in there that has a lot of different browse, a lot of different cover mixed together. And I'm excited to try some this coming year, let it get established. And it'll be a while before I can tell you my thoughts, but on paper, super excited to try it out. And also, if you want to save 10% off at the Prairie Farm, use the code HOFER, H-O-F-E-R, at checkout to save 10% off. And if you're getting ready to put in some EQIP or some CRP, or you need some native grasses or native blends, or you want to try one of their pollinator, backyard pollinator or short grass or anything like that, you can use the code HOFER at theprairiefarm.com and save a little bit of money and restore our native habitat, which is something I've become much more passionate about once I have, became a landowner a couple years ago. So hope you guys enjoyed this episode. We're going to go ahead and get right into it. This is the last call for the Rock Island County, Illinois auction that I have going on this coming Wednesday at 1 p.m. If you are a recreational land buyer seeking a top-end piece, this is it. Like I said, I don't plug. This is the first property I've ever plugged, and it's for good reason because it's extremely special. You can head over to landpros.com and check it out, and hope you guys have a great rest of your week. Let's get into this episode right now. So you mentioned a perennial food plot, which I think is really interesting, and I think all food plotters here the last couple of years have mentioned the lack of rain. We can all relate to how nice it would be to have a perennial food plot, because when you're trying to time an August rain, been a lot of failed food plots here. And so tell me a little bit about the perennial food plot and what would be an ideal use case, essentially.
Yeah, that was, if you don't mind, Kent, I'll jump in there.
Go for it.
It was one of those where I think Kent and I were just driving around from getting back from a podcast or something, and we spitball ideas a lot, and something came up. What about a food plot? Because we'd understood that it was good for habitat. And then in these habitat mixes and these big blue stem or these whitetail or quail or pheasant mixes, I started putting in things that I found out was good food for them. And I thought, well, people kind of create areas of food plots and it's separate from habitat. And then I had a conversation with Judd McCollum, who's with Working Class Bow Hunters. And he was saying that, well, what I would do is I'd create a really good habitat area, and then I'd create a very diverse, what he calls a full palette or full plate food plot, where they've got something to graze on all year, and they have anything that they could want, so that whether it's pheasants, quail, or whitetail, they get used to this traveling from their habitat to this food plot, which is something you want to help create either way. But if you can keep something there all year round, every single year, you could train a buck. You see a buck that, oh man, dude, next year that buck's going to be incredible. Well, now you don't have to worry about making sure you put the exact same thing down that was there last year. You know the exact same thing is going to be there this coming year. And so I went with that, and I just took my own knowledge and picked a couple people's brains on stuff. And there's a few things I really poked on. One, I didn't put any tall grass in there so that the flowers can really flourish. So it's got a lot of little blue stems, Cytotes grama, rough drop seed, Virginia wild rye. And I think I left out Canada wild rye specifically for dogs, because that can kind of get in the dog's noses. It's not super common. It needs a really thick stand, but it can happen. So
just because a lot of people end up bird hunting their deer hunting ground too.
Yeah, crazy. But I feel like shooting birds. Yeah, I would never.
Yeah. Oh no, go ahead, Nick.
Well, and so I put some of those in there, and then ended up with basically a mix that there's a lot of overlapping food for pheasants, quail, and whitetail. I don't know as much about turkeys. I don't know, I've looked into it a little bit. I know that they can scrounge around for heavier legume seeds. But I didn't really focus on the turkeys. I just went with those. And, so we were,
I'll throw something in there for turkeys. Yeah. Cause I, as a hunter, I look over these mixes too and make, I want them to make sense. And turkeys, that really critical. And the same thing for pheasants, you know, during nesting season, actually more brooding, I believe is the right term. If you're like a hardcore ground nesting bird, you know, ecologist, when those chicks are growing, protein is such a huge necessity there. And yes, the legumes, they are going to have a higher protein content. You know, it's like soybeans, you know, or legumes. But there's a lot of prairie plants that are in that family. And so you get it there, but also, you know, flowers bring in insects, and those insects are so critical to the diet for turkeys and pheasants and quail.
Yeah.
And so that's the other advantage for those ground nesters.
And I would say that I think when you see so many of these birds and these whitetail, they're hanging out in these CRP or these monarch pollinator plots, that's kind of a ringing thing. They're surrounded by corn and beans, and what they want is these forbs. They want, you know, just like humans, broccoli's pretty good for you. You would be you wouldn't be a very healthy human if you only ate broccoli. You know, you need a bunch of other things in that diet. And that's what we're hoping to provide. Like Judd McCollum said, a full plate of healthy things, not just of diverse foods, but from April 15th until November. And then we also have a section of these seeds that that I designated, and these are the little more expensive ones, but we designated these seeds to be seeds that we know will hang on through the winter. Round-headed bush clover is one, showy tetrefoil is another. These seeds that, and they tend to be legumes.
I change my pronunciation of that word every time I use it.
Yeah. they tend to be legumes, but they, and higher in protein, which coincidentally works out quite well for a whitetail hunting season. But they hang on through the winter. So
yeah, which makes a lot of sense. I think the perennial food plot is like, I feel like hunting sometimes goes through these evolution phases. And I feel that a perennial food plot, I did not even hear about it 3 years ago. And now there was a counter of the amount of times I've heard it, it's increasing. And I think that it's probably likely for a reason, is just talking about, talking about getting equipment back in on a farm during closer to season, where you have a perennial food plot, and once it's established, I assume maintenance on that is probably pretty low. So, yeah. I mean, this would be like a great adjacent food plot, maybe like a staging area going into a eventual destination food source. It's kind of what I'm picturing this in my head.
You know, a couple of things I want to throw in there, and Jake, you made me think of this, which is a really good point. Just, you don't need near as much equipment, you know. You could technically spray out an area with a backpack sprayer, or maybe get like a small, you know, sprayer with a pump in it, that you battery powered pump that you put on your four wheeler. Then for seeding, these seeds do not need to get drilled into the ground, you know, with openers and closers, and like broadcasting is a great way to seed prairie. And you know, in our previous conversation, Jake, I think we talked about the importance of people not planting too deep. Prairie, when you think about these seeds, they're being dispersed by wind, they're being dispersed by animal hides, they're being dispersed by water runoff, they're staying at the surface. And so when you go to plant these food plots, you don't have to have all that equipment that you do a corn plot or a bean plot. You can literally broadcast the seed, and it's going to come up. Yeah. And so that is an advantage. But also, I think it's important too, when people think of like, this is part of the way food plots have been marketed to us as hunters, is you're only thinking about hunting season. You know, where's my kill plot going to be? You know, I need a crop for my kill plot. You know,
what's most tasty the third week of October to the first half of November?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, if you want to have big bucks, we know now that it's not just purely the great genetics that we have here in Iowa or the great genetics over there in Illinois. Yeah, that is important, but it's also nutrition. And so if you want to have, you want, and not just nutrition for the individual buck, the nutrition of the the buck's mother while she's carrying that buck, as we've learned, is critically important. So when you have, and it really is such a great term that Judd gave us there with the full plate nutrition, you have all those trace elements, those micronutrients, and the to go along with the macronutrients that are needed for ultimate, you know, nutritional benefit for those animals. And so you're going to have a healthier deer herd, you're gonna have healthier bucks. And I think you could even extrapolate from that, you're gonna have bucks that are reaching their maximum potential for antler size, because whatever the genetics they get brought to the table, you can't really control that, but you can control how well they are fed and meeting their nutritional needs. And so it helps with that too. And beyond just the obvious connection of the legume species, I was listening to a podcast, the Mississippi State University Deer Lab, Bronson Strickland and Steve Demers. Yeah, just oh man, the knowledge those guys have. I actually I've talked a little bit with Bronson through messaging, but I've never talked with Dr. Demers. But my favorite college prof was classmates with so my ecology professor was classmates with Dr. Demers down at Mississippi State.
Dude, Kent, you're famous.
No, I'm not famous. But he told this story of how they did like a liver fluke survey where they would cull these deer, and then they would instantly gut the deer, get into the liver, and squeeze the liver, and liver flukes would like slither out of the liver of these deer. But so I've always wanted to meet him and talk to him about that. But I was listening to their podcast, and they were talking about deer nutrition. This was an old episode. This was clear back in 2017. And if you saw me on my phone here, I was looking up this note that I just typed some stuff down while I was listening. And they talked about I think the podcast was just titled "What Do Deer Eat?" And they talked about the fact that 50% of what a deer eats is considered woody browse. And so, you know, I instantly start thinking of when deer are nibbling at maple leaves on, low hanging branches or mineral stumps. That term, I think, came out of that lab too, with Dr. Marcus Lashley when he was there. I think he's down at Florida now, but, just those different tree and shrub resources that we can think of. But then 30% are forbs. 30% of a deer's diet is wow. Consists of forbs. And I'm not as certain as to the origin story of soybeans, but I know for a fact corn is not from North America. Soybeans is from
China too.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking they were a Chinese origin, and soybeans are from, and corn is from South America. White-tailed deer are a native species to North America. They did not show up on this landscape eating corn and soybeans. They showed up on the landscape eating, and they weren't even eating red clover or white clover. Those things weren't here. They were eating prairie.
I'm just imagining a whitetail like 400 years ago. Mom, there's something I'm missing. I wasn't made for this. I was made for a long yellow vegetable,
Yeah. I mean, and corn's been here for a long time now. Native Americans were there. There's a whole unique and interesting history there. You can hear a lot about that in the great book 1491 by Charles Mann, by the way, just put that plug in there. But, they weren't, they didn't adapt eating those things. They adapted to eating prairie. So 30% of a deer's diet is forbs. And when they were talking about it, they said, even though it's only 30% of the diet that deer are eating, it is the most important part of their diet because of the nutritional value. There's so many different species of forbs that all carry their own you know, trace elements and their own different sets of nutrition that meet the dietary needs of a deer the best. The only reason they only eat them 30% of the time is because they have a relatively short season compared to trees, which provide some level of food technically year round. I mean, you can see little tips of twigs nibbled off in the wintertime when it's a real heavy snow year or something like that, or just in areas that don't have the grain litter on the ground for deer to use. You know, so they are browsers. They aren't grazers. They like to go and hit all these different food sources. They don't just, it may seem like deer only eat corn and soybeans because that's where we see them on our
right
trail
at dusk,
or at dusk and at dawn when we're driving, you know, but that's really only a part of what they're eating. You know, a couple years ago, I was setting up a tree stand in September, and my friend Caleb was just like really tuned in at looking at browse lines while he was helping me. In fact, you've met Caleb before, Jay. Great guy. But Caleb and I, we walked into the timber where we're putting up the stand, and you could just see everything was browsed at just the tops. It was all a bunch of snake root, which is a native woodland. I guess it's probably technically a forb, right, Nick? It gets a little white flower in the top.
Yeah.
So it's a native forb, and you can just see
snake root, I think.
Yeah. Yep. White snake root. And they had browsed it down you know, the tops of the plants everywhere. It's just like somebody went through with a pair of pruning shears and just snipped it all down. And it was interesting because while I was standing on my second stick and strapping it to the tree, in came the buck that had been browsing down all that snake root. He's real nice, like 150 inch 10 point. It was just such a perfect example of that, where this deer had just been, of course we saw the browse line in the soybeans walking up to the timber, but then once we got into the timber, this is all activity. Unless you got a trail camera in there, you weren't going to know about it. You know, but that deer was hanging out in the timber, never had to leave the shade in the summertime if he didn't want to, and had a great, you know, a great food source right there to himself. So, you know, and then the other thing too is we oftentimes say, okay, I can see how a flower has a seed that's, you know, useful to the deer to eat, like, you know, that's got protein, but don't forget about the leaves and maybe even the stems, you know, like an aster has a seed that's about the size of a piece of pencil lead, you know, it's a tiny little seed. But when you look at, I just got done cleaning, our sky blue aster, and I had a complete barge wagon filled with all of the, chaff, you know, which is like the stems and the dried up crispy leaves and everything, that the part that wasn't the seed, and like, you know, maybe what, Nick, a pallet full of seed or something like that.
Like five bathroom trash cans, like not that much compared.
Yeah. Right. So it was like, it shows you how much biomass was there on those plants when they're in their growing season, just a tremendous food source there for deer. And so I think that's the part that people forget about with putting a food source on the landscape for deer, is it's not just the hunting time of year that you need to be worried about that food source. It's all year round. And that's what makes a deer feel comfortable on your property, so that you're going to have a doe bedding area when you're hunting the rut and you want to catch a buck that's going around scent checking all these doe bedding areas. You're going to have great October hunting when things are still green and you're itching to get out there and hunt, because it's been a year since you got to, you know, it, like there's all those other benefits that come outside of that magic week in November that provide you with good hunting.
Yeah. And I think one thing that, we have, as hunters, have been kind of programmed for the magazine looking food plot or the TV looking food plot, where it's just a, you know, it's just green and lush, and aesthetically it's very pleasing. I found, and I've ran this past a lot of people, is like, good habitat is often ugly to the human eye.
Yeah.
A lot of times, right?
It's true.
It's aesthetically very pleasing is often not a good form of habitat. And I think that's probably a hard thing for a lot of people to overcome, where like a nasty looking timber with a bunch of, you know, new growth is technically the best, but it's kind of ugly. It doesn't look like a park, and that's what is hard.
Yeah, we love our straight line lawns and, you know, our fenced in gardens, but Good Prairie just isn't that. And then similarly, good food plots, you mm-hmm. know, they're kind of messy. They got all sorts of different, or they look messy. They're sure. You know, there's a lot of organization within that beautiful mess, but mm-hmm. yeah.
What, so I guess diving into this, like, give me for your guys' food plot blend here, like, when do you plant it? What type of prep work? And then what type of maintenance is there? And kind of the quick and dirty for that.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you a quick run through here. You'd plant it basically when you plant prairie. You can plant May and June, or you can dormant seed in November, December, or you can wait till after the snow gets off the ground and plant it February, early March. And that's a frost seeding. So you've got those three different areas you can plant it in. After that, you're going to take the two first summers and you're going to mow the heck out of it. So the first summer, you just don't plan on having anything. You're going to mow it when it gets knee high, mow it down to your ankles. Even if you dormant seed it in November, you're going to do that the whole first summer. The second summer, I recommend knee to ankles the whole summer. It is okay. And you will probably get a pretty good stand of some wildflowers and some food plot viability if you do knee to ankle through the end of June, because then you've got July and August where you've got prime prairie time, and then into September and December where you've got those forbs and grasses that are, you know, fall forbs and grasses. So they're going to be beautiful. They're going to be charismatic. They're going to attract wildlife. It's okay that second summer and fall to do that, but for sure the first, all the way through the first season and then the second season, first half of the second season, you want to be mowing it down. And then after that, it's really just spot weeding or spraying for like Canada thistle, burning it occasionally. And if you're going to burn it, don't burn, you know how we talked about burning late to get rid of brome? Mm-hmm. Don't do that, because that's going to really help your little blue stem and your rough drop seed and some of your other warm season grasses. It's not going to help your forbs that much.
Right.
And you don't want to do a fall burning, right? Because then you just get rid of everything right before you need it. So what we'd recommend is basically a February burning.
Okay.
So,
and you don't need to do that every year. You know, no, so maybe every three. Like, well, what about sheds? You know, because that's what I'd be saying there.
Yeah.
You know, like February is when I'm getting excited for that. And so, you know, this is like every 3 years, you know, is it, but yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Nicholas. That was, it's a good point.
Yes. I think that's most of the maintenance.
Okay. Yeah, which is pretty darn nice. And you get it established. And I think it sounds like this is an excellent form of diversity to, if you're still a guy that I have to have corn or I have to have beans or I have to have my brassica plot. I think it, from what I'm hearing, and I want to try this and I want to implement it and see for my own eyeballs too, but it just seems like just a lot of diversity where it's the guy's like, I don't know what they're eating in there, but they're in there all the time. It's probably exactly what would happen in the back of my mind as I picture this in my head.
No one's done this yet. I'd love to hear of someone who has a corn or a sorghum or something, and directly next to it, adjacent to it, does a perennial food plot. Because in terms of like how much are the deer going to hang out in one or the other, I don't know. But if they're hanging out in the perennial food plot, spend, as much.
Yeah, they're going to spend time in both for sure. You know, because it goes back to the fact that deer are browsers and they're not grazers. Yeah. And so, you know, you can like where I spend most of my time hunting, I have very little influence over what happens on the landscape here. So let's be honest, I'm in South Central Iowa. That means I'm going to be hunting near corn and soybean fields, you know, but, and they work, like those things work. Brassica mixes work. And so we're not saying don't ever use those and it's a waste of your time. Use them, but try and include these perennial food plots in there. Because they are going to add a new wrinkle to your overall management plan that I think you're going to be very happy with having. And, you know, who doesn't love seeing a buck, you know, seeing those white tines coming through that tall grass, man, that's where I get excited.
I couldn't agree more with that. Is there anything else that you can think of when it comes to this perennial food plot? I want to try. I want to see. I want to get it in the ground. I want to, you know, it's kind of the delayed gratification of, you know, and that's the other thing too. It's like a lot of these traditional food plot seed mixes have like grass in it. And so it grows really fast and it looks really green, but maybe it doesn't really have as much nutrition and everything else with that. And thankfully, which kind of leads to the next thing is like, as a human species, I feel like we're all getting so much more educated and we're all learning so much more things about nuances like this. And so have you guys directly seen an increase in curiosity for planting natives and doing pollinators? Definitely. Because, you know, I feel, and it just might be just be with how, like the adjacencies of what people I talk to now. So I'm having these conversations more, but I have to imagine you guys would have a better pulse on, is there just like more awareness and gumption for this type of stuff than even 5 years ago?
Well, let me brag on Kent here real quick. So a couple of years ago, we went to Pheasant Fest and our booth was right next to Doug Duren, area where Doug Duren was speaking several times a day. And Kent, the used to be teacher that he was, would go and sit in those sessions and just smile and nod and raise his hand, ask good questions. And so Doug came on over and he was curious what we did. And, you know, he's a conservationist, so he loved what we had going on. And we asked him if he wanted to jump on our podcast and we said, yeah. And he said later that he was looking us up, seeing, you know, and he looked at our, and he said this publicly on a podcast recently, so I'm not sharing anything that he would, but he said later he's looking us up and he's looking at our website and he saw food plots and he said, he kind of rolled his eyes like, oh, like, oh, whatever, you know. But
Doug's got a great phrase about food plotting. He says, he calls it bringing sand to the beach, because you know, the entire landscape is covered in food here in Iowa. So he's kind of he feels that a lot of food plotting that is done is like superfluous. But just to give context to what Nicholas was saying.
Yeah. Well, and he was so, but he saw what we had and it was like a perennial native and he was really excited about it and connected with us. But so Kent and Doug really connected. I mean, we hung out at Doug's place for a long time and got to see, you know, his farm and his house and stuff like that. But he later went on to Wired to Hunt. What was this, like 3 months ago or something? And talked about our perennial food plots. And I'll be honest, that was the moment we started getting emails. I started getting calls all the time about it. And before that, I'd maybe had 10 sales ever and perennial food plots. You know, like nobody cared about it. And maybe it's coincidental. Maybe he's just part of a mass thought movement. But for sure, there was like, it like turned on a dime for us. And now I get several emails a week inquiring about food plots.
Which I see that trend continuing. I really do.
Yeah. I think, you know, people have been looking around them. You know what I mean? Like they're looking around and they're like, man, there's a lot of things that are not healthy on our landscape right now. They're starting to connect dots. Like you said, I think you said it very well, Jake, you talked about how educated we are becoming as a species, which is good. You know, we have things like this podcast where you can learn so efficiently and YouTube you know, just more people going, you know, sticking in education longer and you know, developing a good sense of asking questions and seeking out answers and having a way to find those answers efficiently through the internet, you know? And so I think people are starting to look around and they're starting to say, man, we got to make some changes here because, you know, our water quality is diminished. Our soil quality is greatly diminished. Our air quality and the way that, you know, our climate is looking now, all these things have been affected by, you know, a whole bunch of things, but one of them is how we're using the land. And so, and then even too, looking at wildlife diversity, not just plant diversity, but looking at what's happened with our pollinator species, you know, a lot of things hovering around that endangered status, especially like the monarch butterfly, the thing we all grew up, you know, doing a little lab in school of watching the, you know, the monarch caterpillar make his little chrysalis and then become a beautiful monarch butterfly. Like we've connected with those things. And when we start to see the symptoms of a degraded landscape, then we're like, we want to do something about it. And so I think that that's really what's driving a lot of this too, is people are, they're waking up and they're asking questions and they're maybe a little bit angry about how things have shaken out for them. And they care about not just whitetail deer, but they care about turkeys and they care about quail and they care about pheasants and they care about all the other species that we can't even hunt at all. And they want to see them here, and they want to have a, you know, healthy, diverse ecosystem around them. And I think that perennial food plots are a way that hunters especially are saying, okay, here's a way that I may not own a ton of ground, but, or maybe they don't own any ground, but they got a lease or they have permission to, you know, mess with 5 acres or less on the property that they have permission to hunt on. And they're saying, this is a way that I can make a small change that can yield a big difference. And you know what? I probably get some better hunting value out of it too. And so I think that, you know, as much as I want to give people like Doug credit, and even you, Jake, you've done a great job raising awareness, yeah, and how good it feels to pat ourselves on the back here at Hoxie. I think the consumer has become more educated, and 100%. they're responding in such a way that deserves a lot of credit and a lot of respect from all of us for doing the right things.
With how diverse that mix is for the perennial food plot, would that fall into any sort of CRP program? Like, would it hit enough marks? Mm-hmm. What are some of those programs that would?
CP25. See, usually they want some more tall grasses in there. So if you called me and was like, hey, I want your food plot, but I want it needs to be a CB25, I could throw in like a pound of big blue stem, you know, or a little bit of switchgrass where it wouldn't totally take over. But so there it would fit in CB33 or short grass quail habitat. That's for sure. There's a new thing in CRP where you need a tall and a short grass mix. You could do it there. That would definitely, I think Monarch Equip, it does. If it doesn't, it's very close, and you know, you could throw in a little bit of milkweed. Yep. So that they would, definitely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's huge. Cause maybe someone isn't getting ready to enroll,
CRP, right. Yeah.
And they're thinking, man, I don't want to give up my 1 acre kill plot, but I have 15 acres. I'm going to enroll into CRP and I can stack in a bunch of, diversity and good food.
Right.
Let the deer browse and go munch on some clover closer to dark.
There's also, there's something I've been working on recently. So we've got like our food plot that's very diverse. And then there's like a upgrade, I guess, where you get the food plot, but then you get basically a legume package. Not that legumes are everything, but they hold on to their seed into the fall better. And they add food for birds as well throughout the winter. But they tend to be a little more expensive. So you can get a really solid food plot for the original price, I think $200 or something, $210. But then for like another $100, you can add these more expensive legumes. Some of them are already in the mix, but you double the amount, something like that. And I recently was working with a landowner and they had 100-something acres, and we decided, we had one of two choices. We could take, he had the budget for 10 extra food plot additive acres is basically what I called it. And he could either pick one spot to put these 10 acres, or he could spread them throughout his prairie and just make a really, you know, diverse, more, habitat food plot friendly area. And he chose to do a little of both. He took 3 acres of it and he put them in one specific spot where he was wanting to have a very thick food plot. He was hoping to get some traffic through that area. And then the other 7 acres, I just threw it in the mix with 100-something acres, and spread that food throughout. And I thought that was just a really cool decision from a landowner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, man, I'm excited. I'm just like jonesing to go work on the farm right now. As we talk about this so bad. I'm like thinking in my head, like, where can I put this and thinking, where it would make sense. So I, that's really awesome. What, and this is specific to whitetail managers, because that's a lot of people that listen to this, but what do you think is one of the most understood, what is one of the most misunderstood aspects of reestablishing native habitat when it comes to habitat management? I feel like we probably answered this, you know, collectively throughout this conversation, but if you had to boil it down to a sentence or two.
I think it's probably the you talked about delayed gratification, and part of that delayed gratification is putting in that work. You know, I like to say that prairie is a rebuke to, what we've become in a lot of ways with how we do things. You know, we want instant gratification. We want to be able to just keep scrolling, right? And see something else that trips our fancy. But prairie was eliminated very quickly. It took a long time to get set up how it was when it was at its grandest point. And it's not going to be won back in a day. It's going to say, you know what, you threw the rock through the stained glass window. If you're going to fix that stained glass window, you better sit down and get busy, because it's going to be a while. Right. And that's what prairie is. It was, we destroyed it literally in, I think it was 70 years, is what historians have determined, basically the lifespan of one generation at that time. You know, just the moldboard plow tilling every tillable acre is what got rid of our prairie. And if we're going to get it back, we're going to have to put a lot of time and effort into doing so. And so prairie is a rebuke in that way. It requires the delayed gratification. It makes you say, as a land manager, man, I can't wait to hunt this in 3 years. You know, thankfully it's not as delayed gratification as hunting, you know, a nice stand of white oaks, but,
exactly. I'm planting a bunch of trees and I'm thinking, I Googled all the subspecies like, oh, it'll produce its first acorn in 45 years. It's like, that's right. All right, well,
you know, really excited to hunt this with my grandkids.
That's right. Yeah. Maybe you can do like a hunting, like a hover round commercial. This hover round got me out to my tree stand. Right. it's not as bad as planting oak trees, but
or even fruit trees for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, even fruit trees. Yeah, you know, it's gonna take a while to reap the benefits, but once you get there, then it's set. You know, and there's going to be some management things you're still going to have to do. You're going to have to do some spot treating. You're going to have to burn. You're going to have to maybe reseed a few areas that get, you know, totally wrecked by something, you know, maybe like reed canary grass creeps in or something, and you got to really rip up the soil to get rid of it. But for the most part, it's going to be set, and it's going to take care of you in the long run. And, you know, I think that's probably, if I had to narrow it down to one thing that people really need to understand about it is, yeah, there's going to be delayed gratification. There's going to be upfront work, but it's going to pay off like you wouldn't believe down the road.
Yeah. And I would say that one of the more misunderstood things that I hear is how people don't understand how big a deal diversity is. We've been talking about that, and there's a growing awareness of it.
Point.
But for instance, even with switchgrass, we talked about that earlier. People want a screen of switchgrass. Hey, what's the tallest switchgrass you have? Hey, so Canlow is the tallest, but you don't want just Canlow. Let's put three or four kinds of switchgrass, even something as simple as a 10-foot wide screen. Let's put three or four different kinds of switchgrass and maybe add big blue stem in there, right? And the diversity, it adds a lot of safety for the screen. You know, it'll last longer, there's more resiliency. And then similarly with a food plot, you don't have any rain. Ah, crap, you know, all these species didn't produce, but you know what did? White sage, rattlesnake master, those things produced really, really well this year, and they're browsable. So I think diversity is a big deal. It's what I preach on here at Hawks and Native Seeds. And and dad always says, you know, people have microclimates and they'll say like, oh, can I get soil samples on this side of the hill and this side of the hill? I'm like, well, let's not get that carried away. You're only getting like 500 square feet. How about this? We'll put 60 species out there and 35 or 40 of them will do really well in their good areas. So diversity, it just comes with a lot of resiliency. And I think if people grab onto that even more than they have, I think we'll actually see more amazing habitat, not just food plot. We'll see more amazing habitat for hunting and for wildlife.
Yeah. I agree with that. Absolutely. And let's say someone wanted to order a half an acre or a quarter acre. Is that something they can just reach out and?
Oh yeah. Yep.
Okay. You can
deal with small quantities all the time.
this is the first year ever that our hunting and habitat and food plot mixes will be available for purchase online. Usually I had people call me in because if you're buying like $1,000 worth of something, I don't want you to be able to make that transaction online and then have to ship 200 pounds worth of something back to me. You know, it's like a mattress company, like, yeah, just keep it. We'll just refund you, you know, but that will not happen. We're going to don't do it. Don't do that, guys. but you know, we're making it in such a way where I think if you're getting like a yard mix, 500 square feet is the smallest we go. And there are standard mixes. But we have a bunch of different kinds and you can see those on our website. But if you're going to go with a wildlife or hunting or food plot mix, a quarter acre, I think is the lowest we go. And I think a food plot quarter acre is like $70 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, guys, I appreciate it. And I think what you guys are doing is really, really, really amazing. And I think that, you know, people can buy seed and I'm a big guy of vote with your dollars. I mean, just because you can save a nickel, support people like you guys, because it's very clear you're passionate about what you do, very thoughtful with what you sell. And to me, if I'm going to pay someone, it's someone like you guys. So, I mean,
I really appreciate that, Jake.
I think anyone that's enrolling CRP or want to try a perennial food plot, or maybe they have their backyard and they get sick of mowing it all the time and they want to do a backyard pollinator. And I think you guys are the people to go check out. So where can people go and do that?
Oh man. Hoxsey, Hoxsey, nativeseeds.com. Hoxseynativeseeds.com, or they can actually order seed on theprairiefarm.com. And if you go to Hoxsey Native Seeds, you'll be able to order from there. It'll take you right there. But yeah, Hoxseynativeseeds.com or theprairiefarm.com.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Yeah. And check out our social media platforms too, at Hoxsey Native Seeds or is it Prairie Farm or The Prairie Farm on Instagram?
The Prairie Farm.
Yeah. The Prairie Farm. Okay.
And you guys have a bi-weekly podcast too.
Yes. Yep. The Prairie Farm podcast, and Jake's been on there, and Doug's been on there. We talked about Doug and a whole bunch
Skip
of
Sly. Others. We talked about him earlier. Man, what a dude. Yeah.
Steve Hansen, where Jake killed a giant buck this year. Had Steve on there.
Yeah.
He tells a little bit about his brown bear guiding days too in Alaska, which is just wild.
Every time I talk to Steve, I learn something more about him that I'm like, really?
I know it.
His stories just don't end. They just don't.
Yeah.
Well, Nick and I always talk about how whenever you hang out with Steve, after you're done hanging out with him, you're like, man, I like that guy.
We were texting today, actually, Steve and I were. So
he'll be like, oh, yeah, no. Oh, you went to vacation in Hawaii? Yeah, I used to underwater weld out there. You know, it's a pretty good time. I got attacked by a shark. You're like, Steve, what?
Because he grew up in Illinois, so I'll be talking to him about like this county or this. He's like, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. I used to hunt this public right up the road.
Steve.
Yeah. Yep. Well, excellent, guys. I really appreciate it, and I think right now is a great time for someone to be shopping for seed or planning a perennial food plot. Or
yes, definitely.
I would say go listen to your guys' podcast if you have questions. Because like we mentioned, there's a lot of ways to. In a crude way, skin the cat on when it comes to this stuff. And the more you know, and the better you can execute, because it is expensive seed and you want to do it right. And I think that was echoed with Kent saying, just do it the right way. don't take the shortcut. But thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Jay.
Yeah, thank you.
There you guys have it. Hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Be sure to use the code HOFER, H-O-F-E-R, at the Prairie Farm to lock up any of the seeds that they provide. A lot of really cool stuff. I really respect what those guys are doing. And there's a lot of places to buy seed, but I believe in what they're doing, how they source it, and the impact it can make for white-tailed deer and every other critter out there. So hope you guys take advantage of that. And if you're in need of CRP or EQIP contract type grasses or mixes, give them a call and I'm sure they can put something together that will fit in the parameters of your program. Hope you guys have a great rest of your week. Until next time, see ya.